Back on March 29th, the people of Zimbabwe went to the polls to cast their votes for president. Almost 5 weeks passed before the government announced the result. Since Election Day, the opposition had claimed victory, but the government said that the opposition leader, Morgan Tsvangirai, had failed to gain enough votes for an outright win and must face the country's longtime leader, Robert Mugabe, in a runoff. For some time, the MDC said that it would not participate, but now Morgan Tsvangirai says that he will contest a presidential runoff, although many people are concerned that there will be violence. This morning, in this part of the show, we'll be talking about the election and what lies ahead for Zimbabwe, and our guest is Scott Taylor. He's associate professor and director of the African Studies Program of the Walsh School of Foreign Service at Georgetown University. He writes frequently on Southern Africa. He was a resident research affiliate at the University of Zimbabwe in 95-96. His articles have appeared in many journals, including the Journal of Modern African Studies. He's the author of three books, among them Politics in Southern Africa, State and Society in Transition, Culture and Customs of Zambia, and The Business and the State in Southern Africa, The Politics of Economic Reform. He's joining us this morning by telephone, and as we talk, questions from listeners are welcome. The only thing that we ask is that people are brief in their comments, and we ask that so that we can keep the program moving along, accommodate as many different callers as possible. Certainly, though, callers are welcome. Here in Champaign-Urbana, the number, 333-9455. We do also have a toll-free line, and that's good anywhere that you can hear us, and that is 800-222-9455. Again, in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455, and toll-free, 800-222-9455. Those are the numbers. Professor Taylor, hello.
Hi, David. Thank you very much.
Well, thank you very much for talking with us. We appreciate it. Well, just to start out with, from the very beginning, virtually from when the election concluded, the main opposition party, the Movement for Democratic Change, said that it believed that it had won and that Mr. Tsvangirai had gotten just enough votes, a little bit over 50%, to be elected out. Right. And certainly they did manage to get enough votes so that they are the leading party, will be the big party in the parliament. Also, I'm sure made the argument that what happened here was that the government held back on the results for long enough so that they could manage to find enough votes for Mr. Mugabe so that they could force this runoff. Do you think anybody really knows what happened here?
Well, the one thing is certain, that the ruling party used all arrows in its quiver to try and get the result that it did get. The surprising thing, it seems to me, is that even with the official results, they're still below 50%, that is, for ZANU-PF, the ruling party.
Mm-hmm.
So the astounding thing, whether or not the MDC is correct in its own assumptions that Mr. Tsvangirai got 50.3% of the vote. The astounding thing to me is that result, the higher that MDC's declared margin was greater than ZANU-PF even in the first round.
This, as I mentioned, that this now is the news that after for several weeks of saying that the MDC said we're not going to take part in this runoff, and I think Mr. Tsvangirai, I'm not sure if he directly said no, but now he has directly said yes, and I'm sure that this must have been a difficult decision. It seemed that the MDC really was in a bad position, that if they didn't contest, that then Mr. Mugabe would win by default. But if they did, they surely must know that the big fear is here is that there will be a lot of violence around this election.
Well, I mean, in some respects, that's absolutely correct. I mean, in some respects, they were in a position, a very unenviable position. Their moral stance, which they maintained for several weeks as the especially since the results hadn't been released, was that they would not contest because they had in fact won, according to their figures, over 50%, and that therefore a second round was unnecessary. Taking the moral high ground, however, is fraught with difficulties, as you point out, because if they did not contest in a second round, even under protest, then Mr. Mugabe is automatically declared the winner, and that gives Mr. Mugabe and the ruling party to some degree a veneer, at least, of legitimacy. They say, well, we've won this, you know, the ruling party, the opposition has failed to contest the runoff, and so therefore we have a legitimate victory. On the other hand, the MDC, if it chose to boycott, the landscape in African countries and elsewhere for parties that opposition parties that choose to boycott on the basis of, you know, this kind of that they feel that the framework is just too biased against them to participate fairly, those parties tend to fall away and never be heard from again. So it's a very fragile situation for MDC, but they really had no choice. If they don't contest, they will disappear probably from the landscape and hand Mugabe a victory. If they do contest, as you point out, there is likely to be violence, and indeed we've seen that over the last few, at least since the results were announced last week.
Yeah, and it's my understanding as well that the government can set the date for this election, and that the government can say something like, well, we're very concerned about the possibility of violence. So for that reason, we think it might be a good idea to wait on this, and that, in fact, that it could set it could put this off for as much as a year.
Yes, I mean, the problem is we don't know what's credible and what isn't. They do have the ability to put it off. The law says that they have to hold it within 3 weeks. They have not exactly adhered to the law in various decisions over the past several years, or have bent the law to suit their purposes. So yes, they can delay it. One wonders, you know, what happens to any energy that the opposition has in the interim, if they are able to delay if the ruling party is able to delay the poll that long. It's anyone's guess, really. I mean, it's a very cloudy situation at this point as to what's going to happen. If the ruling party does decide to go forward with the elections in 3 weeks, or 3 weeks would have to be May 23rd, and I don't see that happening. But if they decide to do it in some kind of near-term time frame, I think we can expect a great deal of violence. I think that they will continue to try to intimidate opposition candidates and its supporters. But there's a real question as to whether that strategy would be successful in an election environment. I think for the ruling party, probably the best course is to try and delay indefinitely.
And in the meantime, Mr. Tsvangirai, who's the leader of the Movement for Democratic Change, the MDC, is not even in Zimbabwe. He was in, when he made this announcement that he would indeed participate in this runoff, he was in South Africa. And so no doubt he's going to have to go back at some point to do what he can to rally his supporters and to gather as much support as he possibly can.
Well, he's due back this week. Again, I don't know whether he'll actually turn up in Zimbabwe. He may, he will most certainly be harassed in some form or another, and he may face arrest. There's been some claims from various people in the ruling party and the security apparatus that he was going to, you know, that certainly we've seen some MDC senior representatives have been brought in for questioning and interrogation and so on in the last few weeks. There's no reason to suspect that Tsvangirai wouldn't at least be fall victim to some of that same kind of harassment in an effort to intimidate in a show of force. This has become the modus operandi of the ZANU-PF regime. Mm.
And if the runoff takes place, and if it could be assured that this was a free and fair election, do you think that there would be any? Would you have any doubt that Morgan Tsvangirai would win?
Well, if that's a lot of ifs.
I know that's a lot of ifs. Yes.
If the election were free and fair, that it sort of presupposes that people have not been so intimidated over these past several weeks that they'll come out to vote at all, and that they won't feel intimidated when they do vote about for which party or for whom to cast their vote. So, I mean, one could imagine, for example, a scenario in which the process is relatively fair, and yet because of this a priori intimidation that's taken place, people come in and vote for Mugabe, essentially under duress. Now, under the interpretation of sort of election observation and so on, that's not free and fair conditions, but it at the same time, it would be a legitimate vote. But there's no way of knowing. I mean, the surprising thing that we've seen again in these last few weeks is that the ruling party really, for the first time in any kind of concerted way, is targeting areas that have been historical supporters of ZANU-PF. I mean, rural areas, Mashonaland provinces, areas where ZANU-PF has historically had a strong constituency, and sort of punishing people for in areas that were seen to have supported in this last election, Tsvangirai. So I think it's a real open question how much that's sunk in and how people are, you know, how they'll react once they get into the voting booth.
Yeah. Our guest in this hour of Focus 580, Scott Taylor. He is associate professor and director of the African Studies Program of the Walsh School of Foreign Service at Georgetown. He writes frequently on Southern Africa, and we're talking about what's been happening recently in Zimbabwe. Questions are welcome, 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. I think that there are some people who have argued that those who were best positioned to put pressure on Mr. Mugabe, that is from outside, are other leaders in Southern Africa. And of all of them, the one who people believe really should take the lead on this, should be in the lead position, is Thabo Mbeki. He's the president of South Africa. At the same time, it seems that Mr. Mbeki seemed to be unwilling to put pressure on Mr. Mugabe and at the same time has seemed to be unwilling to do very much to help Morgan Tsvangirai.
Yeah, and Thabo Mbeki is really is quite an enigma. it's very difficult at this point to figure out what it would take to have Mr. Mbeki speak up vociferously against the violence in Zimbabwe, let alone Mr. Mugabe's manipulation of the election results and the ruling party's manipulation. But Mbeki has gone from pursuing this policy of quiet diplomacy and so on to really being an enabler of the regime, and it's a puzzle. Especially when you see other countries in the region are in SADC, in the Southern African Development Community, are trying at least to move beyond the Mbeki, the bulwark against action against Zimbabwe. You know, Levi Mwanawasa in Zambia, for example, has been quite vociferous recently, and other countries are saying we need to take action. You see some action from various presidents in the region, in Botswana and Tanzania. But Mbeki has resisted and resisted. And quite frankly, I mean, at this point, it's gone beyond puzzling. And for those of us who are concerned about the trajectory in the region, find ourselves looking towards the almost towards the post-Mbeki future and see, the next president in South Africa, maybe it'll be Jacob Zuma, will be more forceful against these kinds of manipulations in Zimbabwe.
Well, you wonder, or I wonder, there seems to be sort of two parts to this. One might be how he feels about Robert Mugabe and his role having brought Zimbabwe from Rhodesia, from the British colony, to the independent country, and whether that has something to do with his feelings, that is, Mr. Mbeki's feelings about Morgan Tsvangirai. Does he have some sort of problem with Morgan Tsvangirai?
Well, Mbeki's not is reputed to not be a fan of Tsvangirai's and has rebuffed him on a number of occasions. And so clearly there is this duality here. One is kind of clearly favoring Mugabe, and the other is disfavoring Morgan Tsvangirai. So, but it's hard to see what it's hard to see what Thabo Mbeki's rationale is at this point. I mean, you know, the old song about the liberation struggle and Mugabe's importance to it. It's worn kind of thin at this point. I mean, it's worn thin to South Africans, let alone people outside the region. The sort of Robert Mugabe right or wrong kind of approach that he's taken is just puzzling. I don't do enough psychohistory, psychoanalysis to figure out why Mr. Mbeki is so reluctant to intervene strongly. I mean, I suspect, you know, there are these historical factors. There are the gerontocratic factors, and Mugabe is sort of seen as at one time at least, as an elder statesman in the region. There's the liberation network and sticking together as former liberation movements and all that. But at this point, with all the difficulties that Zimbabwe is causing for South Africa, with the tens of thousands of Zimbabweans flooding into South Africa, the ever destabilizing situation in Zimbabwe, it's just at this point it's gone from curious to just bizarre in terms of why Mbeki has refused to take up the lead on this.
Yeah. We have one caller here, someone who'd like to join in on the conversation in Urbana. Let's do that. Line one. Hello.
Well, hi, how are you?
Good.
I've had a running complaint with Sub-Saharan Africa for a long time. I had a friend that whose brother was a lived in Zimbabwe for years as a agricultural specialist. He was actually forced to leave because he was put on a hit list by the government about, I'm guessing, 6 years ago, something to that effect. He's never returned. And he has a great remorse about the dissolution and destruction of that country. And your discussion about Mbeki is real interesting because the Chinese weapon ship that was sort of turned away from the ports and the port workers refused, the government didn't care. And this whole thing about their attempt to get Mugabe out, he won't leave, to discuss elections free and fair it's got to be one of the great jokes of all time. And it's interesting how the Chinese have moved into Africa now, sort of with their, communist government and, protecting Myanmar or Myanmar and all this other stuff and Vietnam and all these other people. And the West just sort of standing by going, I guess I don't know what to do. Just let them dissolve or, self-destruct. And what always concerns me about these things, because I was in Southeast Asia for almost 40 years ago and killing off all those, the innocents that got in our way. And I look at these people and I think, the average person there is so screwed and is so victimized by the Mugabes, the Nigerian ruling juntas, and all these people that pretend at the elections and all the money involved, and now the Chinese are moving in and they have a really bad human rights track record. Could you discuss that part? And it's really funny because when I was in high school in the 60s and then went into the military and then went into college and spent like 10 years and going to graduate school, I used to still follow these third world countries. And the West used to send in, assassination teams and kill off the guys they didn't like. And now we sort of I'm not suggesting that, but we sort of stand back and watch these people murder their own citizens under the guise of they're in my way. And no one says anything. And, I mean, there's all these discussions about World War II and genocides and, Rwanda. You can go down the list, and it's just amazing that everybody just kind of goes, well. And I'm wondering what you think about that issue. It just really bothers me. It's bothered me for years. And I just don't understand why there is not outrage. I mean, where's the Congressional Black Congress? And, I mean, the committees of black congressmen and stuff that complain about racism in this country, and Africa's disintegrating right in front of their eyes. Nobody says anything about this. Could you address that issue? Thank you.
Well, there are a couple of interesting points that the caller makes. I think that first and foremost, we have to be a little careful about painting all of Africa with one brush. I think the examples that he raises, certainly, the situation in Nigeria currently, or that in Zimbabwe, and as well as a number of other countries, are cause for concern, if not outright alarm. At the same time, there are a number of other countries that have made substantial democratic progress and are peaceful and are growing at 5 or 6% per year and have made some moves towards reducing poverty and so on. So we need to be a little bit careful to say that every country is, you know, there are 53 countries in Africa and they are all worthy of differentiation. That being said, he raises a number of important points. Let me just say first, regarding South Africa, you know, I am very critical, and I think and increasingly people in the region and elsewhere, certainly our foreign policy establishment, the Europeans, and again, even in Southern Africa, are critical of Thabo Mbeki and his lack of leadership on this issue. That's a very important factor. But at the same time, the recent behavior he talks about with the dock workers in Durban refusing to accept the Chinese arms is not only encouraging notion about sort of regional solidarities and in fact labor solidarities between South African labor unions and the largely labor union built MDC in Zimbabwe, but it also talks about the strength of South African civil society, I think, and that's actually a positive statement on South Africa, notwithstanding its leadership on this particular issue. The Chinese role and the Chinese intervention in Africa, this is, you know, the Chinese have drastically expanded their trade and investment in Africa. I think the trade figures are up around $80 billion per year now, which is just an increase from only about 700 million 10 years ago. And so the Chinese are increasingly positioned in African countries. The Chinese will say that they're not interested in politics and that they don't intervene politically, that they're just pursuing economic relationships. Obviously, and the Zimbabweans have said, well, this was just an ordinary arms shipment, but it's part of our ongoing relationship with the Chinese. I think, to their credit, the Chinese recognize that this was a political football, perhaps because of the Olympics and everything else that they're and the situation in Tibet and everything else. They recalled those weapons from Zimbabwe and did not import them ultimately into Zimbabwe. So, although the Chinese have been part enablers of regimes of all stripes in Africa and indeed all over the world, they're driven, I think, first and foremost, not by communist ideology to the extent that even exists anymore in China, but by economic opportunism. And some of that economic opportunism has had very negative results for its African partners. As far as the violence of the Zimbabwean regime that the caller also talked about, I carry no brief for this government or what it's been doing, but most, and this is not to excuse it, but most of the violence that has been done in that country is sort of of an indirect form. I mean, the displacement of people from an Operation Clean Out the Trash in 2005, where they bulldozed urban housing and displaced a lot of people. The economic crisis that's been induced by bad and deliberately bad political decisions and policy decisions that have increased unemployment drastically in the country and poverty rates, and so that people, hundreds of thousands of people don't have sufficient access to food. I mean, this is the kind of violence that this regime is doing, but it's not a direct kind of slaughtering people in the streets kind of violence. I don't think that necessarily makes it any better, but let's not obscure what's going on in Zimbabwe. This post-election environment, in terms of the MDC says that 30 or 35 people have been killed, is a horrible situation. But that kind of direct brutality has been more exceptional than not in Zimbabwe over the last decade or so.
Just to return to conditions in the country, for a moment to pick up on one of the points that Connor made. And certainly, one of the things that we know is that most people in Zimbabwe are having a terrible, terrible time. Very high unemployment. People are having a very difficult time just taking care of the basic needs of life. It is said to have the highest inflation rate in the world. I can't even quite grasp this. It's said to be 165,000%.
Right.
I can't hardly even grasp. it seems like it's sort of hard to overestimate just how tough times are there for people. And one has to wonder whether even within the ruling party, even within ZANU-PF, there would be people who would feel that things are so bad that a change would have to happen. Is there no one within ZANU-PF who could say to Mr. Mugabe, look, Mr. President, we have failed our people here, and we just can't keep going on the way that we are?
Well, the question sort of presupposes that that Robert Mugabe is the one driving this whole, you know, this maintenance of power and this whole debacle following the election and so on. He may very well be, although there are some reports that, in fact, the security apparatus, the military, the armed forces, the police, the Central Intelligence Organization, and various militia leaders are holding sway, more sway than he does within the Politburo and the decision-making structures of the ruling party. It's a bit tough to tell. Certainly there are dissenters. We know that there are dissenters within the ruling party itself. But there's still enough, you know, you talk about 165,000% inflation, you know, this Weimar Germany type inflation. And you start to wonder, you know, when is their economic wealth, however ill-gotten, at what point is it so endangered that they think we need to cut our ties or cut our losses and get rid of this guy and move forward and allow, you know, some of the economy to return and so on? They're still, surprisingly enough, even in this inauspicious economic conditions, they're still doing well enough, or enough of them are doing well enough that they want to stick with the status quo, that they're better the devil they know in Robert Mugabe than the devil they don't know in Morgan Tsvangirai and MDC. And so as long as there are access to some, you know, remaining rents, they're still making money off the mining industry, for example, off some commercial agricultural products and so on, and land has been reallocated to generals and various members of the security services and so on. As long as that continues, you know, we're in a bit of a stasis. I don't know how long it can continue. Certainly you would expect that this economy is imploding at such a rate that this can't go on indefinitely. But, you know, I think we've been surprised before. Others were saying, well, this would all give out years ago, and it certainly hasn't.
We are talking this morning in this part of Focus 580 with Scott Taylor. He is an associate professor and director of the African Studies Program of the Walsh School of Foreign Service at Georgetown University and writes frequently on Southern Africa. He was a resident research affiliate at the University of Zimbabwe in 1995 and 96. He's written articles in many journals, including the Journal of Modern African Studies, and has authored several books on the politics of Southern Africa. And we're talking about politics of Zimbabwe. Questions are welcome, 333-9455, and toll-free 800-222-9455. You know, I think with as much as I have read about the election and what happened before and after, I think that I still would have to say that I'm not sure I have much of a feeling for who Morgan Tsvangirai is and what it is he believes in and what it is he stands for and what he would do if he became president of Zimbabwe. Tell us more about him.
Well, Morgan Tsvangirai was the longtime leader of the Zimbabwe Congress of Trade Unions. He's a trade unionist. Rose to the trade unions in Zimbabwe from independence in 1980 through the late 1980s, early 1990s, were essentially controlled by the ruling party. It was a Zimbabwe was a country unlike, say, Zambia, or unlike South Africa, which had a history of weak labor movements. And Tsvangirai emerged, you know, towards the end of that decade in independence, the first decade of independence, as the leader of this movement. You know, a charismatic figure, a powerful, he emerged as a powerful representative of the working class, and got into trouble with the ruling party as the Congress of Trade Unions began to strengthen. From about the 1997 period is when you saw the Tsvangirai-led labor movement start to really take on a more political tone and become more vociferous and outspoken about, principally about the state of the economy, but it started to get into more into politics. And Tsvangirai took an increasingly public profile, and then when the MDC was established in September 99, he became the leader of the party. He is, how do I describe it? He's ethnically Shona, and that's been, at times he was seen as something of by his critics as a puppet of the Indibele minority, because many of the senior ranks in MDC, in the original MDC at least, were held by Indibeles, and Tsvangirai was seen as sort of a figurehead. I don't think that's a fair representation exactly, but I think he's a important player in his own right. He's been jailed a number of times by the government. He was accused of treason a couple of years ago and went on a very convoluted legal process and trial, where he was ultimately acquitted. I think the process was more intended to intimidate him and silence him than it was to actually convict him of treason. But so he's remained. He's also hasn't been universally popular even within the MDC. People have criticized him from saying he's not intellectual enough, and that in part gave rise to his rival Arthur Mutumbara 3 years ago and the establishment of a rival faction of the MDC. He's been described as not, you know, but he doesn't appear to have the mobilizing capacity, at least anymore, to get people out in the streets no matter what to protest the regime. So I would say, you know, that the whatever vote percentage he got, and I think we can, even the official results are that he got a plurality of the votes, were not because the populace of the electorate is so enamored at this point of Morgan Tsvangirai, but that that it was as much an anti-Mugabe, anti-ZANU-PF vote as it was a pro-Tsvangirai vote.
Mm-hmm. Now that... as a result of the elections for parliament, the MDC is the majority party. Is it possible for the MDC to govern through parliament? Any possibility that there would be enough, they could put together enough, attract enough supporters from other parties and maybe even some ZANU-PF people to actually put together enough of a base and power in parliament to be able to do anything?
I personally don't think so. I mean, you know, the MDC got 99 seats in the House, in the lower house of parliament. 9 seats went to the other faction of MDC, the so-called MDC Mutumbara faction, and 1 seat went to an independent. So 109 seats then to ostensibly opposition parties out of 210 seat lower house. Setting aside for the moment that a number of seats are still being recontested or contested, which is problematic, let's assume that the 109 seats is maintained for opposition parties, or one of them is an independent. I don't think that even that majority in the lower house gives the opposition enough clout to really affect governance in Zimbabwe, at least as has been practiced over the last 10 years. It's interesting. It's important that there's an opposition voice there. It's certainly more than symbolic. But ZANU-PF will still have there's a split in the upper house of parliament, in the Senate, and the president has the capacity to expand his side by appointing a number of seats. So at the end of the day, it'll be almost 2-to-1 advantage for ZANU-PF in the upper house, and as long as they control the presidency, Zimbabwe, like many regimes in Africa, strongly presidentialist, and most of the power and authority, constitutionally and extra constitutional authority, flows from the executive. It is not a first among equals arrangement. It's a strongly presidential system that accords most of the authority to the executive branch.
And I gather that in fact, any legislation to come out of the parliament, the president has the authority to veto.
Right.
We have about 10, 15 minutes, well, maybe not quite 15, maybe more like 12 minutes left in this part of Focus 580. We're talking about the politics of Zimbabwe. Again, our guest is Scott Taylor. He's associate professor and director of the African Studies Program at the Walsh School of Foreign Service at Georgetown. Questions welcome, 333-9455, toll free 800-222-9455. We talked a little bit earlier about the feeling of a lot of people that, first of all, if there's anyone who is in a good position to put pressure on Mugabe and the ruling party from outside, it would be other southern African leaders, and the main one being the president of South Africa, Thabo Mbeki. And we also talked about the fact that his unwillingness to do that you can speculate, but you said it's kind of puzzling. No one's really exactly sure why it is that he's taken the kind of position that he has. So if you set aside African leaders, is there much that anybody else, say the government of the United States, the government of Great Britain, any other country, is there anyone who is in any position to have influence here?
Well, I mean, that sort of speaks to something that the caller raised, which was, you know, why is nobody, he was saying, why is nobody condemning what's happening in Zimbabwe? Mm-hmm. I would have to disagree with that, with the notion that nobody is condemning what's happening in Zimbabwe. In fact, it's become quite loud and increasingly universal condemnation of what's happening. I think outside of the region and outside of Thabo Mbeki, that Zimbabwe has very few supporters now. I mean, China is providing an economic lifeline, and a very important one, but politically there are very few that are defending the ruling party at this point. That's a change, because, you know, even as recently as the last election or the interperiod between elections, Zimbabwe had a lot of very strong supporters. Now there are still some in Africa, the men and women in the street outside of Zimbabwe, mainly, who still have some admiration for Mugabe. I think that's misplaced, but there's some there. But again, he's becoming increasingly isolated in the region. Now, does that mean that they'll do anything about it? I'm not sure. I mean, because there are pros and cons to any action that they might take, direct or indirect, against Zimbabwe. As far as the outside world, outside of Africa, I mean, the U.S., Condoleezza Rice has recently was reported to contact a number of regional presidents and urging them to kind of keep up the pressure on Zimbabwe. She's particularly been in conversations with Zambia's President Mwanawasa. Jendai Fraser, the Assistant Secretary for Africa, was out in the region about 2 weeks ago, again, meeting with regional presidents and so forth, and quite vociferous in her condemnation of the situation in Zimbabwe. The British, of course, have long time been critics of of the situation in Zimbabwe. So there's a lot of outside pressure. Ban Ki-moon is now urging how the UN, you know, trying to figure out how the UN can play a role, and has expressed some concern about the violence taking place in Zimbabwe. So there is, you know, this outside interest. How that translates into real policy in Zimbabwe when the government itself is intransigent, when they're refusing, for example, in the event there is a runoff, they've refused to have any outside observers for the runoff, just like they had, they didn't have it. They had some 40-plus observer teams for the March 29th election. None of them was from unfriendly, what the Zimbabwean government deemed unfriendly governments. The EU wasn't there. None of the U.S. groups were there, and so on. So, you know, as long as they're unwilling to open up, short of some kind of military action, which I think would be absurd and ridiculous and would have ultimately very negative repercussions. There's not much that the outside world can do, surprisingly enough, or disappointingly enough. In the Kenyan situation, for example, where Kofi Annan played a very, very important mediating role between the powers there, it was because they both welcomed him. Both sides were sort of looking for a way out, and Kofi Annan was able to play a mediating role. In the Zimbabwe case, the government and Mugabe himself has been quite unwilling to entertain this kind of thing.
Yeah, although I suppose you have to ask, in with the Kenyan case, just whether the two men actually can work together or not. That seems, doesn't that still seem to be kind of an open question?
Oh, in Kenya?
In Kenya.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, the situation is not entirely resolved there, but what I'm suggesting is that at least there you had a willingness to allow third-party mediation, and so there was a base from which to proceed. In Zimbabwe, there's a complete unwillingness for that kind of thing, and again, in the Kenya situation, you had essentially between President Kibaki and Odinga, you had relative equality of power in terms of the constituencies they controlled and so on, and you had a real increasingly real risk of civil war or major conflict in the country. And so, you know, that was an added incentive. In Zimbabwe, it's still the case that even with their 40-whatever percent that President Mugabe got, even with all this pressure and with all the problems that they're suffering economically and otherwise, the government still holds all the cards. And so that's the difference between, you know, this Kenyan situation of relative equality between the actors. In Zimbabwe, the MDC does not have, you know, the pull or the wherewithal to force the president to the table, and thus far he and his military and security supporters have been unwilling to do it, at least publicly.
Yeah. Matt's trying to get one more caller here in the time that is left. Line one, Champagne. Hello.
Yes, I just came in the conversation, and my knowledge of this issue is so shallow. But I don't know if you touched on it, and I want to ask, what role does the confiscatory policy of the head of Zimbabwe with respect to the white farms and the white lands, how does that play into the political spectrum here?
Mm. Well, there's very little white land in terms of the agricultural sector left to confiscate. And so, you know, most of that has been redistributed, not incidentally to the poor and landless, as was at least rhetorically the objective initially, but to mostly to those who are connected, you know, politically or militarily to the government. As far as the restoration of that, I mean, part of the thing that Mugabe has played on, he played on in the run up to the March 29th elections, and is continuing to use this in his rhetoric, is that you know, Tsvangirai will come in and give all the land back to white farmers, and so this just represents a recolonization of Zimbabwe. We finally achieved sort of a liberation of the land, and now Tsvangirai and MDC want to reverse that. And so Tsvangirai has had to be a bit delicate about that issue. On the one hand, promising the restoration of the rule of law and the respect for property rights, which would seem to say a return to the status quo ante of 4,000-odd white farmers. On the other hand, he's promised to try and have land inquiries and land commissions to try and rectify land imbalances in a legal and orderly fashion. It's a difficult path for him, and it's a bit of a rhetorical device that the president's been able to exploit.
Well, thank you, sir.
Right. Well, I think that it is fair to say, and you correct me if this is wrong, that this land redistribution policy has a lot to do with the fact that Zimbabwe went from a country that actually could export food and certainly could feed its own people to a country that was relying on imports of food.
Yes, I mean, there's a direct correlation between that and not only the agricultural collapse, but the overall economic collapse, because it's had a knock-on effect on not only on exports and therefore on foreign exchange earnings, but on investment and concern about the economy and so on. So that has had a ripple effect throughout the economy.
Yeah.
That land seizure has been a disaster.
We have just a couple of minutes left. Earlier we were talking about Thabo Mbeki, the president of South Africa, and you said you didn't really think that you had the ability to look into his mind. So I don't know that you'd feel any more able to look into the mind of Robert Mugabe. But having said that, you know, the question that everybody seems to ask and everybody wonders about is what is this man thinking? And why is it that he seems to have been willing to run the country into the ground and push so many of his people into poverty rather than somehow admitting that perhaps he might have made some mistakes or his government might have made some mistakes and might say that perhaps after all these many years in power it was time for him to step aside and give somebody else a chance?
I think it's a combination of Louis 14 and 16, l'état c'est moi and après moi le déluge, you know, this belief that the country can't survive without him, and that you know he is the sort of the rightful not proprietor but steward of sort of Zimbabwe's future. That would seem to fly in the face of all the empirical reality. I'm very cautious about venturing down that path to try and figure out, you know, what's inside Mugabe's head. I do know that there have been, you know, various reports that he's misinformed, that he's surrounded by sycophants who continue to tell him what he wants to hear, and that, you know, the people are happy and things are going well. I find that a little, incredible, because he's certainly not a stupid man, and I don't think he's crazy. I mean, I have met with Mugabe myself a number of years ago, and one is impressed by his command of facts and his general sort of awareness. Although he's in his 80s, I don't get the sense that he's declined so much that he's lost those faculties. I don't know. It's very difficult. I mean, I think that he's really concerned about if he and his inner circle, if we turn over the country to these upstarts, to these people who don't have liberation war credentials, who didn't fight for our freedom in Zimbabwe, that we'll be condemning the country to ruin, that they'll reverse all the gains that we made from independence. And that has resonated to a surprising degree politically, at least up until this last election, with a number of people. But beyond that, I'm not sure I would want to hazard much of a guess.
Well, we're really at the end here. We know that there's going to be this runoff now between President Mugabe.
Well,
I guess that's the right thing to say. At least at this point, we think there will be a runoff. We don't know when. At least Mr. Tsvangirai said if there was one, he'd participate. So other than that, what do you think is going to happen here now over the next few months?
Well, I mean, I have written a lot recently on this whole issue of the securitization of the Zimbabwean polity and the creeping presence of this security military apparatus. So I have to say that I'm, regardless of what happens in the electoral process, I'm skeptical of that set of actors' willingness to kind of surrender their advantage and their gain, both economically and in terms of the political power that they enjoy. So, you know, it's almost, you know, I'm not quite at this point, but I'm almost willing to suggest that regardless of what happens to Mugabe, in the medium-term future, there aren't a lot of happy outcomes. You know, if Tsvangirai wins the election, it's a remarkable, or if that's revealed, it's a remarkable outcome. But I'm not sure that he'd be allowed to govern.
There we must leave it. Scott Taylor is Associate Professor and Director of the African Studies Program at the Walsh School of Foreign Service at Georgetown. Professor Taylor, thank you very much.
David, thank you for having me.